Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, June the 15th, 1996. In the fireside room this morning, our speaker is Jane Frankenberger. The title of her session is Watering Seeds of Hope, Global Mission Today. Let's listen in.
My name is Jane Frankenberger, and this session is called Watering Seeds of Hope, Global Mission Today. So it looks like we're a relatively small group, and maybe we can we'll be able to share quite a few of our experiences. But just to get a sense of our involvement in Global Mission, I want to ask a few questions, several questions, so just raise your hand if they apply to you. How many of you have worked or volunteered overseas? No one here. Okay, that gives me a sense. How many of you have traveled overseas? Ah, everybody. Okay, how many have been to a Global Mission event? Our ELCA's, what some people have called the most exciting events in the ELCA today. Okay, how many of you find it easy to remember that we're all part of a global church? So, sometimes easier and sometimes harder, I know. Okay, I want to talk about a few things today, especially relating to the global church and how we as a church today are trying to be of service to people overseas, and how people in other countries are in mission to us. And I'm sure that since all of you have traveled overseas, you know that how much we are given in our interactions with people in other countries, and especially people in the church. Just as an example, the wonderful song at the end of the wedding yesterday, when we sang "We Are Marching in the Light of Christ," that song comes from South Africa. It's a gift to us that's become fairly well known in the Lutheran Church, and it's just an example of how much we are given from our brothers and sisters in other countries. So just to get started, I wanted to show you some of the countries. Since I didn't have maps out last night, were many of you at my slides last night? Okay, so I had slides there, so that's why I didn't show slides again today, but I brought the map today, and I also put out this one of Division for Global Missions brochures to show you a few things so that you can look up close, because I think this map is much too small for you to see. The country where I spent 5.5 years as an ELCA missionary is Senegal, this green country here, and it's also green on your map that's at the inside of your insert, so it can give you a little better idea where it was. I also lived 2.5 years in Zaire, which is this country, probably the largest country right in the center of the continent of Africa, which you may hear about some. I was thinking about, what are the DGM puts a lot of emphasis on getting maps out so people can see where the countries are. And I don't know if that's helpful or not as kind of a geography lesson. I mean, in the end, do we really need to know where the countries are? But what I think is good about it is that it gives us a picture that across the entire world, around the entire globe, if this were not flattened out, our church is at work. And even more exciting, I think, is that even in countries where the ELCA is not at work, many other churches are, from Roman Catholic Church, Methodist, Presbyterian, Episcopalian, Anglican, so we can be assured that though we're just one small part of the body of Christ, that Christ's name is being known and people are worshiping and being served by Christians around the entire world. So even though sometimes in our own churches, and I know I go to sort of a suburban type of church now, because my entire city seems to be like a suburb in West Lafayette, Indiana. It is very hard to remember that global connection, but we can know that it's always a part of us. The other thing, as I was getting out these maps, I saw these wonderful posters, and these are actually put out by Lutheran World Relief, and I'm sure they're too small for you to see back there, but if you want to come up afterwards and look at them, They both have a water theme, and I want to begin by talking about that, the connection of water as part of our summer theme, and our baptism. This one, the verse is, "Everyone who thirsts, come to the water," from Isaiah, and shows people drinking from a well, and points out that half of the world's population lack easy access to an adequate supply of pure fresh water, and in some rural areas, only 29% have safe water. And so it gets us thinking, as we are so blessed with a plentiful supply of water. And this one says, "Out of God's heart shall flow rivers of living water." And that's from Jesus. Okay, so these aren't quotes from the book of the Bible, but it reminds us of the connection between water and life around the world. Martin Luther said, "When we wash, remember our baptism." I think that's how the quote goes in the church I go to now. It's hung up above the sinks where you wash, and I found it delightful. It really has helped me to think. Every time we're washing our hands, we can remember our baptism. But I think another little discipline that we could take on is that every time we drink water or drink all the other things that we have, we can remember those who do not have access to clean water. How many of you have walked to Heart Lake? Okay, well, we know it's a long ways. And I thought David Messenbring the other night at the forum brought up a good point that we remember how tired we are walking that far. Many women around the world are walking that far to get water. And they may be carrying it on donkeys or whatever, or they may be carrying it for a mile or two on their heads. But water is a great burden for many people. And another thing that I'm thinking about, and I'd love to have more discussion on this, is working on the relationship between clean water here in the U.S. and clean water in Africa, which is where I'm most familiar with. As some of you know, I work specifically with water and water quality at Purdue University, protecting our water supply from the contaminants that are common in the United States, and these are mainly pesticides. Some of you might be concerned about pesticides in your water, contaminants that come from animal manures, including nitrogen, phosphorus, and pathogenic microorganisms. These are problems in the United States. Though we as a nation have made a commitment to clean water, we need to be vigilant to keep it clean. And some of you may know that Holden Village, for example, is needing to put in a new filtration system on their water supply. This is a huge expense, but it's part of the state of Washington's requirements that all public water supplies that come from the surface, which this does, must be filtered. So it again shows this state's and our nation's commitment to clean water for everyone. People in much of Africa, certainly Senegal where I was working, and the other countries that some of you might have visited or heard about, after people are walking miles and miles for water, much of it is contaminated, especially what comes out of surface sources. And this is, again, here in Washington, any water that comes from a surface source, and you understand that, right? That's a stream, it's as opposed to a well, must not only be treated with chlorine, but must also be filtered. And that, of course, is in great contrast to the kind of places that many women might be getting water out of at present. So one of one of the things that I particularly want to emphasize that the ELCA and our church in general in Global Mission today is working on is water. And Lutheran World Relief puts these posters out specifically because drilling wells, which ensures an excellent supply of water. If you drill a well and put a pump on it, for the most part, that water is going to be very clean and really bring new life to people. So that's one of the ways that our church is doing mission today. And I think that we can all remember that in our daily lives. As we walk, as we drink, we can remember that many people don't have access to it, but an important part of Global Mission today is bringing that hope. How many of you were here for the forum on Tuesday? Some of you might not have been around that long. Okay, so some of you came in since then. Okay, so I don't want to repeat myself too much, and those are the kind of things I was thinking about for this session. The question for that was, where is hope in Africa? And I'm sure that's a question that many of you struggle with as you hear day after day the bad news about Africa. And what I emphasized then, and I'll emphasize again today, is it's in the small scale that we can find hope. I mean, if we think in a large scale, even about the U.S., sometimes it's hard to see hope for a lot of things. But we need to keep hearing those stories, and I want to share a few of those with you today. And first of all, as we talk about water, I want to talk about one of the women that I worked most closely with during my years in Senegal. She was in some of the slides last night, so I'm glad you got a chance to see those. And so I won't show her particular today, but her name is Jo So. And she was probably in her 40s. She was divorced, which of course is of some stigma in that culture, and it particularly leaves you without a man, and a lot of the resources are allocated in terms of men. She was very strong-willed, just an incredibly dynamic woman from whom I learned a lot. And the way the Senegalese government and a lot of the national aid programs, USAID is one of them, our program, the European Community is another, was using the wonderful resource of the river, was to go into villages and start large irrigation projects, and they would tend to split up if they started an irrigated rice field, and it split up a certain amount of land to each household, to each family. Well, the way that translates in many cultures around the world is each family means each man gets a portion. So Jo, because she was a woman living alone, had to rely on her cousin's field, who were men and who were actually away, but they had access to a field and she didn't. Well, she felt very strongly about this. She felt really that the women did not have enough power. And so she was the main one pushing for a garden and pushing for an irrigation supply, separate from the men, because as we started to talk about a garden, as we started to talk about access to water for the women, one of the thoughts is, well, why don't you just connect in to the irrigated rice supply, the pump that goes up to the irrigated rice fields. So you can imagine that would be a sensible way to sort of divert some of the water over to the women's gardens. But Jo was the one who said, we're not doing that, because those men, if they have control over our water, they'll at some point have control over the garden. So we absolutely need our own supply. So she would often tell me about how things used to be in the old days, and I'll just share a little bit about that with you. In those days, they all had large herds of cattle, and they would migrate from the river and down to the more desert-like area in the rainy season. And she would always tell me there was plenty of milk. That was a sign of plenty. I think it's sort of like in biblical times, milk and honey is great plenty. So if you're a people that are used to living from cows, it's that plenty of milk that was a sign of plenty. But she's had to completely transform her life. The cows died mostly in the drought in the 70s, which was a terrible drought in that region of the Sahel, which, as you can see better on your little map here, is almost part of the Sahara Desert. So she's had to completely change gears in her life and has gone from being a herder and being a married woman to now living by herself, but making her way, leading the irrigated garden of these women. So I think there's a lot of hope in stories like that. She gets those other women to get out, and you know, if people are neglecting their little job, she'll get them out doing it. She manages the money. She's as honest as can be. And for me, she was always a sign of hope. A very intelligent woman who has had no schooling whatsoever, completely illiterate, but very smart And it was really bringing hope to all the women in her village by leading the garden project and leading the irrigation project. So that's where we find hope, with women like Jael. Okay, I have several other sort of aspects that I want to talk about like little stories about global mission. But another one that I wanted to mention at this point, water is certainly something we're thinking about. Peace and reconciliation. Is certainly a priority of global mission today, too. And there are many ways in which we can carry this out, just as here in the U.S. there are many ways in which we can work on peace and reconciliation. But one thing that's happened recently is the support of the ban on the use, production, stockpile, and sale of landmines. And if you've been going to the Bible study with my sister Barb, you might have heard her bring up prayers that included about landmines. She's been very active in this issue. Now the Division for Global Mission has brought a resolution before the Church Council, which was then passed by the Church Council. So it's official that we are calling on individuals and congregations to write letters to the President of the United States and members of Congress in support of such a ban and in support of the U.S. government contributions to the United Nations Voluntary Trust Funds for mine clearance. Because just to review about landmines, they only cost a couple dollars a piece. They're spread in many countries, but to clear one costs I think it's estimated about $500. And again, Lutheran World Relief is working on this as one of our, you know, sort of small-scale organizations, and they certainly can't do the problem alone. But clearing landmines is such an important part of the vision of global mission that we have to be involved in it. But probably the more important part is for us to be active in calling for their ban, because they're really not necessary. They're completely an anti-personnel kind of thing. And we feel as the church that in response to our sisters and brothers' needs around the world, calling for a ban on landmines is one of the most important things we can do. So that's an example of another aspect of global mission today that may not be the traditional view that you have of missions. Another country I want to talk about is not the country I was working in, Senegal, but if you look back on your map again, it's Liberia. I think it's easier for us to look at our own maps. It's the pink country. No, it's not. It's the orange country that's like two to the south of Senegal. Does everybody see that okay? Mm-hmm. Down the coast of Africa. Liberia is you may know, closely connected with the United States. It's where freed slaves originally went, and we've long had a close connection. And we also have a close connection with our church. Those of you who have gone to global mission events or others might have heard Bishop Ronald Diggs speak. Has anyone heard him? Okay, well, he was this dynamic, charismatic bishop that came over and had touched many people's lives, I think, because he was so much fun. You know, he told a lot of jokes. He led singing with actions, and he was really quite very, very lively for a bishop. So that's a connection that many of us have with Liberia. Well, I think that you probably have heard about Liberia in the news over the past few years. It's a long-standing civil war. Gosh, well, it's probably gone on 6-7 years. And finally, they thought that a solution was in sight. A ceasefire was signed, and our missionaries went back. One of the missionaries, her name is Betty McCrandall, as well as several Lutheran World Federation international staff were back in Liberia working this spring when things really looked hopeful. Now, our hopes were dashed. So this is where sometimes we need to reach for another kind of hope and not optimism in human solutions. But very sadly, the ceasefire broke down, fighting broke out again, and the Americans and the other international personnel were escorted across the city of Monrovia by the American embassy and evacuated. So tragically, they're now in the neighboring country of Ivory Coast or Cote d'Ivoire, still working for the Liberian people, but because of the fighting, they're unable to be there. But I think what I'd say is the what it says about our mission commitments is, first of all, presence. Even in the time when things are not so stable, I mean, there were not a lot of Americans that had gone into Liberia after the ceasefires. Things were still pretty unstable, but these very committed people, Betty McCrandall has spent I don't know how many years in Liberia, very many, and she went right back in as soon as the opportunity was there. She was back in Liberia working, and she only left because the Americans had to. And now what they're working on, if you can see any of these, are working on refugee ministry, and which is another part of our mission in the many places around the world where people have had to leave their home. The church is at work there too. I want to tell you about a completely different ministry, one led by former Holden people who have often been up here working, named Dennis and Meredith Murniak. At least Meredith has. I'm not sure about Dennis. Dennis has too? Okay. And I believe they worked with fish farming here. So many of you know about them. Dennis and Meredith are professional fish farmers. They're extremely well trained in this, you know, fairly unusual profession. There isn't a lot of fish farming going on in the U.S., although there is more and more. Like my university, Purdue, has a program now in aquaculture. So it's something we're encouraging in this country, too, especially as some of our large lakes you can't eat the fish out of. We can keep them cleaner by putting them in water in ponds that are built specifically for them. So they took their wonderful profession and went to Tanzania and worked with fish farming there. And I'm just going to read a short paragraph from something that they read because it's about the same issue. And they start, "We must search amid the hopelessness for the little signs of hope. Hope is not found in the headlines or the evening news. It's found in the simple stories of ordinary people making changes in their lives. The changes may be small, but they can transform and breathe new life into families and communities. There's a sparkle of hope in the eyes of young Danieli the day he stocks his small pond with fish for the first time. A ring of hope can be heard in the voice of Joyce, a widow with five children, as she talks softly to her new dairy cow while milking. Both Danieli and Joyce hope their actions will help bring them out of poverty to a life more closely resembling the life God wants for all God's children. They found their hope through a Lutheran program of holistic ministry. Danieli and Joyce participate in the integrated fish farming project of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Tanzania." So I won't read all about it, but they stock the fish, they build their ponds. That's a lot of the work. An enormous amount of physical labor goes into building ponds, and then you stock it with fingerlings and feed them for many months, and then harvest it. So it's a ministry that takes place in water. It's not specifically of water, but another way that we can connect water and people's needs.
Were you here when Meredith was here?
No, I never have overlapped with her here at Holden.
Holden gave her a scholarship to go to New England. I mean, she had majored in oceanography. And then they sent her out to the school, but she came back here. And they put fish out here in the pool because of the cyanide. And they all died. I mean, they grew to a certain point and all of a sudden they just died. So they realized that the cyanide for the mine in the tailings was polluting the waters and the fish couldn't exist.
Huh.
Before she was married, you know, and then her husband, they were married later. But sort of started here, you know, that the fish, if it's in polluted waters, they're not going to live.
Okay, well,
so
thank you for pointing out enough.
What she's doing over there.
Great. It's wonderful for any way, I think, that we can feel connections. And now we here at Holden, since we're part of this community, we can feel part of the original mission that sent Meredith to study
right.
fish and to work on the fish ponds out here. That's very exciting. And they're still there in Tanzania doing wonderful work. It also points out, as you say, the close connection between the quality of water and our and life in every way, whether for what can harm us drinking and what can harm the fish. And so, of course, that's my favorite topic of water quality. And that'll give me another story, sort of a way to connect these two things, water quality in the U.S. and water around the world. Thank you.
Jim, how big are the ponds they make? Are they really big ponds?
Well, I could look in here. The ones I saw in Zaire were probably a half an acre. They were big.
Big, yeah.
But I'm not sure if that's the best way or if there's different kinds of landscapes that have you build different ones. Oh, here we are. No, they do very small ponds. From each small pond, about 30 feet by 45 feet, a family could harvest 75 to 100 pounds of fish per year.
Yes, sir.
Well, there you are. Those are very small. So it would obviously be more intensive, and I think the quality of the water is an important issue in a small pond like that. You need to keep it clean enough so that there isn't a drain on the oxygen supply. But I'm no expert in fish farming, but I think it would be very exciting to go visit them. So
it also that they discovered the fish that they had up there were like the ones of the biblical time that the disciples used?
Huh.
I mean, there's some connection with the early... a fish at that time.
Huh, well, that's very exciting, too. I mean, I noticed they said here, Jesus didn't teach people to, they said, yes, it is. The freshwater fish that Jesus is thought to have used is called St. Peter's fish, or tilapia. Anyway, this tilapia is grown in many parts all over Africa, and it's really an exciting sign of hope. So, good. Well, I'm really glad you're here, Gertrude, and know more about that. But I mean, I hope this gives us an idea of other signs of hope in a continent in which hope is sometimes hard to find. Let's write this. I think this is getting very hard to see. Okay. Another way in which we are doing ministry around the world. Oops. Is primary health care. And to talk about primary health care, I have to talk about my friend Sushi Engelbrecht, who is pictured on this brochure of Explore Missionary Opportunities. But anyway, it gives you a slight picture of her. If anyone is remotely interested in exploring missionary opportunities, I'd be happy to talk with you more. Sushi, I originally met at St. Olaf College many years ago. And when I was back from working in Senegal, back on home leave for a few months, I just bumped into her in a restaurant. And it turned out that she had been with the Peace Corps in Niger for many years. And so I feel that an important contribution I made was convincing her to now join the mission of the ELCA. And she's been in Senegal now for more than 5 years. And she's been there 7 years. And she is an incredible woman. She has her degree in public health, and she's a nurse, originally a nurse, and then she has a master's in public health. And she has set up a network of primary health care huts across sort of a whole province of central Senegal, quite a number of villages. And the way she does it is to train a woman and a man in each village. If a village wants to have a primary health care hut, they're called health huts, they need to present a woman and a man, and then they'll get trained. And the woman will usually be the midwife, and the man will work on other aspects of the nursing situation, but they at least need to have one woman to be the midwife. They get trained, and then a village committee forms, that's sort of the health committee, and then they have to put money into the central pot, and then somebody goes off and buys medicine, and then when somebody gets sick in the village, medicine is there, the simple medicine. I mean, this isn't something you'd get treated in the hospital for, but the kind of medicine we take for granted is now available in the village itself, with a person that at least has sort of a basic training in when to dispense this medicine. And so the village feels a commitment to the healthcare system, to their village's healthcare system. It's not like a visiting nurse who comes from the outside. And they are empowered within their community to manage their own healthcare. The reason she's so unusual is because her specialty is also family planning, and you've never seen such a good instructor on things like use of condoms and other kinds of contraceptive things. She's been very active in that. I think you have to have a certain personality to really like doing this in a very conservative society, and she's very funny. So she's just a delightful part of our ELCA's global mission, and I think that helping people plan their families is an important part of hope in Africa today, because many people want to have fewer children and they do not have the means by which to do it. I mean, wanting to have fewer children is not enough. You actually, you know, in a typical married couple, you actually have to have the means by which to have it. So modern contraception is an important in part and is part of our healthcare ministry. In another part of Africa, Tanzania, the same place that Dennis and Meredith are working, a wonderful doctor is working primarily on AIDS education. That's one of their main focuses. And I'm sure you've all heard of AIDS in Africa, right? This is something that hits the news, and we know that AIDS is very widespread among all kinds of people in Africa. So that the church having to leave its sort of traditional role and step into AIDS education is sort of a jump, as it would be in this country. I mean, our churches aren't usually doing AIDS education. And there's some opposition among the conservative church leaders. But he's, you know, really encouraging them to be in the forefront of age education as preventative medicine.
May I ask a question?
Yeah, please.
What is the philosophy of bringing Christianity to a Muslim nation? Is it through these kinds of projects? I was curious what your role was in Senegal.
Okay, that's an excellent question. Many of the kinds of ministry I've talked to about today fall into sort of the larger category of holistic ministry. And I think that's how we would say is the ministry is. Evangelism, well, the goal is certainly that all people be able to hear the good news of Jesus Christ, wherever they are. But given the great mistrust between Christians and Muslims here in the U.S., as many other countries in the world today, one of our goals was simply to live in peace with our Muslim neighbors and to help them to understand that Christians are not evil, as is often the stereotype there. Just as in our country, many people have a stereotype of Muslims as being terrorists and bombers. I mean, I was just reading something recently that reminded me of an event a few years ago, which you all remember, the Oklahoma City bombing. How many people assumed at first that this was Islamic terrorists who had done this bombing? I mean, people are quick to jump to conclusions like this. There is a real mistrust of Muslims in this country. There is also a real mistrust of Christians in many other countries. So part of our hope is to live together, to be able to talk about our respective faiths in a very non-threatening kind of atmosphere. But as we grow to trust each other and to learn from each other, because as I said, this learning goes both ways, part of it is to be able to share what we believe. That was the level at which I was always involved, you know, in people's lives. They weren't doing any active evangelism. But the area, well, let me tell you another story. This is what it makes me think of. We were in a very Muslim neighborhood area, but there were Christians from the south of Senegal, and then there were a few of us that were missionaries. I worked with some Finnish women because we're working along with the Finnish Evangelical Lutheran Mission, and so every Sunday we would worship together, probably about half Senegalese and half Europeans or Americans, but we always had a worship in one of our homes together, and people in the town, some very conservative people, I mean, this was not the majority opinion at all, came together and said they didn't want Christian worship in their town. Well, the Senegalese church leaders, because there is a Senegalese church, were very upset about that because there is a move to make Senegal more of a Muslim country. It is not now legally a Muslim country. It's legally a secular country, and people of all faiths are free to worship. So they really wanted to fight this. So we had some big meetings with, you know, we brought in our bosses because, you know, so it was at the highest level, and there were these old men, you know, in beards and their hats listening, and we all had a big meeting. And we said, we believe in prayer like you pray, and probably most of you know that Muslims pray very regularly, 5 times a day, in public. Well, they don't see us praying very often, but that's the word we would use. We want to pray. Some of them took the position that they were surprised that Christians ever pray. They had no idea that we did. And the others took strongly the position that, well, they said a couple things that were memorable. First, it was, We can't let this go on because these people are, it's only like a spark, but just a spark can burn a whole village down. So we don't want, you know, anything that has anything to do with Christianity in this village. So our first response was we were overwhelmed that they had more faith in the power of the gospel than we often did. We certainly didn't imagine that Christianity would take off in the way that they were envisioning it was. And the other thing was that some of them felt strongly that people can pray individually, Christians can, but as soon as two or three are gathered together, then we're going to call it a church, and we don't want any church in this town. So we thought that was very biblical of them as well, to recognize that when two or three are gathered together, Jesus Christ is there amongst us. But that opinion ended up being the minority opinion. It was a huge discussion about whether Christians could pray. And in the end, the government official said, no, it's the law of the land, Christians can pray. And I think a lot of people heard about that, and it ended up being a very good sort of quiet witness, because we weren't going out and saying, you need to become Christian, but announcing that we pray as well, and that people can live together in peace. So I'm not sure that I'm qualified to give the whole philosophy, but evangelism, and particularly reaching out to the world of Islam, is one of the priorities that of our church's mission, and it has just been reaffirmed as that. So we're going to continue to study ways that we can be most sensitive and understanding of Muslims, while humbly sharing the good news that we have, I guess. So we're trying to set up opportunities. Another part of the work in Senegal is an urban center where there are classes in, literacy, sewing, and this is literacy both in French that many people want to learn, and in Pular, which is their traditional language, which most of them do not know how to read or write. There's basketball for young men. There's just a whole bunch. There's a library, which is very popular, where people go to study. And there's a lot of opportunities for contact. It's just a very active center. People are coming in. They sometimes have, I think their average is like 500 people per day go in and out. It's very active. There's nothing like Bible study or evangelism regularly, but it's known that this is a Christian center, that Christians are present in the community in this way, and everyone is welcome to come and go, and we want to be of service to them. That might be a little more open, probably, than where I was working, much more in a very conservative small rural town. In the city, a lot of things are more fluid, so there's probably more opportunities there. Does that answer the question? In a very long, very long way. So it's tricky, and those are difficult questions, but we do believe that Jesus' words of out of God's heart shall flow rivers of living water, for example, and that Jesus' words have something to say to all peoples. Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of the Jesus film, which is endorsed by Billy Graham?
Uh-huh.
They're showing it all over the world because they want to preach the gospel to every creature. And they've had a lot of Muslims who have responded positively to the message of Christianity. And I'm wondering to what extent, but what they try to do after large numbers, say they want to be Christians, what they try to do is to refer these people to local former Christians, I mean people who have been Christians from a former time, so that people can be just not left by themselves, but continue to be strengthened in their faith and encouraged in their faith. And I'm wondering, what you know about how that really works out, whether the people, really do continue to seek information and be given it. And whether how many of them may hold on to the faith that they claimed after hearing this film.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do not have direct experience, but I know that there was a group, I think it was Campus Crusade, who wanted to have large showings of that film in Senegal. Some of us who had been there longer were very cautious about that because, as being guests of the country, I think something like that, which is very evangelical, it's possible to bring more opposition as well, which would lead, close doors to ministry. But it is very open, and we don't want to. It's not that we're secretive about what we are, but we're trying to enter into people's lives, be present in all their needs, and be able to share good news in that way. The Jesus film is more, I think they come in and show the film, try and get large numbers of people there, and I'm sure it does change some lives. I don't have direct experience with that, but I would be afraid in a country like Senegal, which is 90% Muslim, that there's a lot of room for opposition. Because, of course, Islam varies as much as Christianity, right? There are the fundamentalists, there are the sort of more open-minded people, and it sort of goes in and out. There are different factions, and there are certain fundamentalists who would like to kick Christians out altogether, and then there are, different levels of seeing the possible relationship between Christians and Muslims. I think as long as we keep a very humble attitude that we are there to be of service, however we can serve, their needs, relationships will remain good. And if people showing the film have that same humble attitude, I'm sure it can bring good things about. But unless it's sort of a triumphalistic Christianity, better than Islam, then I'd be very uncomfortable with it. Anne?
Which countries in Africa now really have Islam as the official, now Sudan has become...
Yes, Sudan is the one that may, I think of.
And so been evicted because if you aren't willing to do a certain stuff. What other countries has Islam become the state religion?
Yeah, Islam is probably the best example of a place where there's the present government, which is from the north, has brought Islamic punishment and all kinds of things into the government. There's a large Christian faction, which is one of the reasons for the long-scale civil war. Not Egypt. There's a secular government fighting against Islamic fundamentalists, right? Niger, probably... does. Mauritania, which is just to the north of Senegal, certainly had an Islamic government. a few of the others in the north.
There's comes in with the Christian message anymore, which is one of the things that you don't want to. I think that would be the danger of the Jesus film. You give power then to the elements that want to say we are going to make this only an Islamic.
Okay, if you see, that's how I would see it. That's a caution that we'd rather that people the separation of church and state. I don't think it's too Western an idea, but that it seems to be a good for people who are of many different faiths. It's certainly not an Islamic idea to have church and state separate, but it's an important thing for Christians to be able to live in as minorities. There's a few others that would be across the Sahel. In Niger, the ELCA had originally tried to go about 20 years ago and were kicked out by an Islamic government. But since then, there's been a number of changes, so I couldn't even say for sure. It goes back between military and democracy, and now I think it's back to a military coup, or did they just have an election? I'm not exactly sure about Niger. So they would sort of go back and forth. But many of the countries in that area do have larger and larger conflicts between the Muslims and the Christians, Nigeria being the biggest example. Nigeria, you may know, is the most populous country in Africa with over 100 million people. And it's about half Muslim and half Christian, although they'll never quite publish those figures because, well, people have all kinds of theories why they won't publish the census figures. The Christians think it's because the Christians are actually the majority, and so the Muslim government won't publish the Christians. But I'm not really sure, but it's roughly half and half. And there are periods where they live in peace, and there are periods where Muslims attack churches and Christians attack mosques, and a very terrible conflict. So there's an important place where just Christians and Muslims living together are the most important ministries that we can bring. Because we don't have to go far from home to know the conflict. I think this is one place where our global mission can come home to us, too, because many of us probably have Muslim neighbors or friends in their churches. Just out of curiosity, how many of you know a Muslim person in your town? Depends on what kind of towns we come from. Okay, probably people from larger towns are more likely to know them, because Islam is now, I believe I heard, the second largest religion in the U.S. Would that be right? Larger than Judaism? Anyway, Islam is...
I think if not, it will be soon.
Maybe that's how I've heard it. But there are many figures. In other countries, like in Western Europe, I know I heard that there are more Muslims worshiping on a Friday at the mosque than there are Christians in church on Sunday, which is rather astonishing. Even if they're not the majority. So Islam is certainly not a religion that's only in Africa or only in the Middle East anymore. It's become part of the U.S. too, and we need to seek ways to live in peace.
Another question.
Okay.
What do you say to people who do not see the value of a global mission church?
Okay, those are very important questions, and some of you might have more experience from your congregations than me. The value, I don't know. I think we have to remember that it's a fact that the fastest growing part of the church, and really, in some, we got to admit, probably the most exciting part of the church, is not in the U.S. or Western Europe at this point. It's in Africa, Asia, and these very exciting points. So I guess selfishly, we could say that they're part of the church, and there's a lot that we can learn. Maybe practically, what we need to do is develop more means of contact between. I mean, maybe you can invite a visiting African pastor or something to the church, and many people's lives have been touched, I think, by visitors who have come to their congregation as missionaries, effectively, because they have so much to teach us about spirituality. Anne shared on Tuesday night about how their life had been changed by a Namibian woman living with them for several years. I think it's in contact that we really begin to see the value of that. But that's a really good question that we probably need to talk. Does anyone else have an answer to her question?
I think of the LWF as when we feel so paralyzed sometimes hearing the world events and the struggles and the hardships and wondering how we can help. The LWF has such a good history throughout the world of being there as an aid agency so that, I mean, when we give money to the World Hunger Appeal, which some of it goes, doesn't it, to
Yes, a good, very good part of the Hunger Appeal money.
LWF, that those are, LWF is one of the agencies that's immediately often in places of conflict in the world and has over the years established good relationships with other ones and a way of our being in places of need when we can't sometimes figure out how we can do it and feel paralyzed and, you know, not knowing how to help or in what ways we can be of help.
Mm-hmm. It's also one of the world's strongest aid groups, is the Lutheran World Federation. And the money goes directly to the need, not to administration, not to people back here. It's designated right there where they need it.
Yeah. So if that helps people see.
With our government even.
See, be involved.
I think when you think about missions, it was real dramatic to me in Namibia to hear, and I didn't get to see the plaque, but apparently up in northern Namibia, there's the plaque about the first Christian baptism that happened in Namibia. And it was the Finnish missionaries that were there for 20 or 25 years educating, providing health care, all these things in a quiet way before there was one Christian baptism. And now Namibia is the most Lutheran country in the world. So I think what you, I think when you think about missions, people sometimes think, well, why aren't you doing this or why aren't you doing that? I think the most effective mission probably is being with the people and offering what they need and what they're asking for. And then when they ask why, because boy, I mean, Lutheranism in Namibia is dynamic and pervasive. And the north, the southern part where the German missionaries were and probably had, well, their armed might came in with the missionaries. It's much, I think it's much more mixed. Where in the north, the Finnish missionaries still, I think, are very beloved. And Lutheranism is, you know, the heart of that part of the country.
Okay, so yeah, so presence
so
both ways. Our long-term presence there, and then as people come into our lives and are present in our life, we're transformed too. I want to tell you a story of hope for me. I'll tell it to you, but I want to start by asking, is it Dorothy? Is that right? To read a very familiar story to us. It's the story of the disciples on the way to Emmaus. It's an Easter story, okay? But the story I'm going to tell you is actually a Christmas story. But for me, it's been an embodiment of this Easter story of how they're on the road to Emmaus and meet Jesus. So I think this story is familiar to all of us, but let's listen to this, and then I'll tell you a story about the synagogue.
Okay, this is from Luke 24, and it's verses 28 through 35. As they came near the village to which they were going, he walked ahead as if he were going on. But they urged him strongly, saying, "Stay with us, because it is almost evening, and the day is now nearly over." So he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. They said to each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he was talking to us on the road, while he was opening the scriptures to us?" That same hour they got up and returned to Jerusalem, and they found the 11 and their companions gathered together. They were saying, "The Lord has risen indeed, and he has appeared to Simon." Then they told what had happened on the road and how he had been made known to them in the breaking of the bread.
Okay, one of the projects that I was involved in Senegal and showed a few slides of last night was with some solar pumps. With the help of the Belgian government, so the heavy capital investment which this was came through the Belgian government. And one of the things we needed to do, because solar pumps only pump in the middle of the day, was to build large basins to hold the water so that the watering could be done at night and in the morning, which is a much better time to water crops. Okay, so the pumps would, the sun would rise, the pumps would start out slowly pumping a little bit, and then they'd pump faster and faster. And right at noon, they'd really be churning out a lot of water. And we needed to have basins that could hold basically an entire day's worth of supply. So they were large basins. And we were building them out of reinforced concrete. So again, it was a substantial capital investment. So the Belgian sort of organizer of this project had bought in Dakar, the capital city, all the cement and all the rebar, the long bars that you need to put into reinforcing the concrete. I learned a lot about all these things. I was an engineer, but we only learned about equations when I got a master's degree. This is where I actually learned to build things. So he arranged in Dakar, and he sent up a truck with the supplies for the cement basins for all the garden projects. So there were quite a few of them. And so he sent along a guy to sort of be with the truck. So we were waiting and waiting for this truck to arrive. Finally, it arrives on Christmas Eve. And I can always remember that Christmas Eve. It was, you know, a really dismal day, and we spent the entire day. My mom happened to be visiting, so she really got a taste of Senegalese life. We spent the entire day trying to figure out how to get these supplies off this truck and over to one of the gardens, and then sent on to the next garden. And the garden that they needed to go to was across the river. They were sort of an island out there, but they needed to go in those boats, which you might remember from the slides last night, these sort of wooden dugout canoes, and these long, I think they're 12 meters long, so 36 feet long bars, needed to go in these things, plus a lot of bags of cement. And so it was just completely a mess. I mean, you'd bend over these rebars and load them in, and of course the bags of cement absolutely can't get wet, right? And the women don't traditionally paddle these canoes, so they had gotten their sons, the young men, to help, but then they wanted to be paid, and the women were screaming at them, "No, you gotta help your mothers. What's wrong with you, you worthless kids?" And we're trying to load these bags up, and then so you can imagine, I mean, that was quite a sight. Then the other thing was the truck had to go on to the next site, and because the road was washed out, it had been negotiated how much the truck would get for the whole trip, but with the main, the shortcut road, but there was a flood, so we couldn't go on that road, so we had to go like 40 miles out of the way, and so we had to pay extra, and I didn't know how much to negotiate, and well, if any of you have haggled in markets, I mean, it's a little bit like that, trying to get a decent price. It was just a very, very long day, and very miserable, and a whole day of screaming. I mean, my mother couldn't believe too how much I could yell at these women, too, because we're trying to get all this work done. So we finally finished in the evening, and the Senegalese man who had been with the truck now wanted to get back to Dakar, which was about 7 hours away by public transportation, which is those vans you might have seen last night. But by this time, it was about 5 o'clock at night. And he said, "How can I get a van back to Dakar?" I said, "Well, I don't think you can make it tonight. There's no possible way." And it turned out that he was a Christian from Dakar and was just crushed to realize that he was not going to be back home for Christmas Eve, which is the big celebration there. I mean, Christmas Day, not so important, but he had really wanted to be back down on Christmas Eve. And of course, in my Norwegian tradition, that's how it is too. Christmas Eve is really the big celebration. So there we are, 5 p.m. He can't get back. So I said, "Okay, well, you may as well spend the night with us. And, you know, so come to my house because, you know, that's what you do, hospitality. Somebody doesn't have a place to stay. They need to stay with you." And, well, then I realized that we didn't have anything to eat. It was the most miserable dinner you could ever imagine. I mean, sort of found some rice somewhere, some old leftover something, and, you know, cooked it up. I can't even remember what it was, but I just remember it was the worst Christmas dinner I've ever had. It was completely pathetic. So my mother and I tried to make things a little nice because it was Christmas Eve. You know, we put some candles on the table and we brought out our miserable little meal. And we were feeling fairly down on everything. And then suddenly we realized that this man, who this sort of unwanted Christmas visitor, but, you know, he was there. He had come to us, and so we received him. His name was Emmanuel, which, of course, means God with us. And suddenly we remembered. And that's why I have the story that Emmaus wrote, because it was like suddenly it came to me that, that God is with us through the slogging, through the you know, the mud, trying to get the rebar onto the canoes and not break the sacks of cement, and that, that God is with us through all this. And it's in those stories of living with the people, suffering through those miserable times, that God is with us, and God is present in global mission around the world. So now I guess I've stopped at exactly the right time, 11:30. But I'd be happy to talk with more of you, any more of you, about more questions you might have. But thank you.
Thank you.